psychoanalytically informed interpreter can take this a step further and say that some, if not the major portion, of the inner hidden meaning of Parzival was also unconscious to its author. Wagner himself not only acknowledged this unconscious dimension in his work, but indeed readily conceded its primacy. In 1856 he had written, "How can an artist expect that what he has felt intuitively should be perfectly realized by others? Seeing that he himself feels in the presence of his work, if it is true art, that he is confronted by a riddle about which he too might have illusions, just as another might." Given the limited time available to us today, let me anticipate the crux of my otherwise stepwise and methodical argument in stating that what Parzival saw was what Freud dubbed the primal scene, the Urszene, the witnessing by the young child, whether in reality or fantasy, of its parents engaged in sexual intercourse. Like Parzival confronting the Grail ritual, the young child at the time of witnessing this intercourse is not in a position to know rationally or verbally what it has seen, though it draws provisional and fateful, albeit inchoate, conclusions. Otto Fenichel cites a patient who characterized his own primal scene aptly as the overwhelming unknown. Of course, if what Parzival saw in the Grail ritual of Act One is a sublimation of the primal scene on a symbolic level that we must be prepared to interpret, nonetheless, this symbolic representation in Act One gives way in Act Two to the primal scene on a quite literal and graphic level, to which we shall return. Meanwhile, casting a shadow, as it were, over the whole of Act One, indeed over the entire work, is the figure of Amfortas with his bleeding wound that will never heal. The shadow of Amfortas was so large, in fact, that Wagner long puzzled over how to configure the narrative such that the figure of Parzival himself would not be overshadowed by that of the suffering Grail King. In Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival, Wagner's principal source, Amfortas's wound is explicitly a genital one. In Parzival, Wagner transposes the locus of Amfortas's wound to his side, partly to parallel the wound in the side of the crucified Redeemer, but the genital symbolism of the wound in the side, like the conventional and euphemistic wound in the thigh, or a wound in the groin, so commonplace in medieval literature, and readily understood as such by its contemporaneous audience, remains clear enough, if for no other reason than that the wound was inflicted during and as a result of sexual congress with Kundry. Amfortas's wound has been inflicted by Klingsor with the Grail Knight's own holy and patently phallic spear, in a quite transparent emblem of the castration threat lurking at the heart of every primal scene witnessed by a male child. Excited by what he sees, the child wishes to do what he sees his father doing, wishes to replace his father in the sex act. The father, in turn, looms as a retributive figure, threatening the castration with whose reality the child has already been impressed, observing his mother's genitals in the turmoil of the primal scene. As Freud wrote in his case history of the Wolfman, quote, "He understood that women are castrated and that instead of a male organ, they have a wound which serves for sexual intercourse, and that castration is the necessary condition of being female. If Amfortas' wound that will never heal is freighted symbolically with the anxiety of the castration complex, there is trenchant irony in the fact that the wound has been inflicted by Klingsor, who is himself literally castrated, and by his own hand to boot. An sich legt die Frevler Hand. On himself he laid the sinner's hand. The hand figures prominently also with respect to the spear. Gurnemanz apostrophizes the spear thus, Ich sah dich schwingen von unheiligster Hand. I saw you brandished in most unholy hand. Then, Der Speer ist nun in Klingsor's Hand. The spear is now in Klingsor's hand. And at the conclusion of Act Two, when Klingsor hurls the spear at Parsifal, Wagner directs that Parsifal erfasst den Speer mit der Hand, grasps the spear with his hand. A significantly gratuitous specificity. What else would he grasp the spear with? For Freud's Wolfman, castration anxiety was, I suppose we should say, overdetermined. It was a sequela not only of the primal scene witnessed by the boy at age 1.5. At age 3.5, Freud writes, he began to play with his penis in his Nanya's presence. And this, like so many other instances in which children do not conceal their masturbation, must be regarded as an attempt at seduction. His Nanya disillusioned him. She made a serious face and explained that wasn't good. Children who did that got a wound in that place. That masturbation was a matter of consequence, not to say an obsession with Wagner, is manifest in the fateful and notorious letter he posted in the fall of 1877 to Dr. Iser, a physician Nietzsche had consulted in Frankfurt. Nietzsche suffered most of his adult life with general ill health, including migraines, failing eyesight, and intestinal disorders. Over the course of 4 days in October, Dr. Iser and an ophthalmologist, Dr. Kluge, examined Nietzsche fully and determined that in addition to a chronic inflammatory condition in his central nervous system, he was probably going blind. Nietzsche reported these grim results in general terms to the Wagners at Bayreuth, prompting Wagner to write Dr. Iser directly, advising him that Nietzsche's physical problems were doubtless the results of chronic masturbation. Nietzsche later characterized this indiscretion as eine tödliche Beleidigung, a mortal insult, that rendered his breach with Wagner irreconcilable. To recognize that a complex of feelings, fantasies, and prohibitions surrounding masturbation underlies the imagery of Klingsor's self-castration is important for a number of reasons. First, we have to pose the general question, how and why a fanciful narrative such as Parsifal, set in the Middle Ages, and composed as it is of all sorts of magically inflated elements, remote from the reality of bourgeois life in 19th century Germany, is taken seriously by its modern audiences. What leads to its assimilation, not just as a fanciful fairy tale set to sublime music, but as a parable of human nature? The answer is that each of the magical and inflated elements refers, through the medium of symbolism, to a more mundane, quotidian fact of life. Ultimately, the whole of Parsifal is a representation of the reality of the human situation. In the case of clings or self-mutilation, for instance, we must be struck by just how bizarre an act it is, if taken on its face. And while not perhaps absolutely unheard of in real life, it is still so rare an occurrence as not to impinge on our actual lives at all. Quite the opposite is true of masturbation, of course. Taboo notwithstanding, nothing could be more quotidian or normal. Thus we have in Parsifal the curious circumstance that whereas Amfortas's wound is symbolic of castration, Klingsor's actual castration is symbolic of masturbation. And these two meanings reverberate mutually, as we see in the threat of the Wolfman's Nanya. Stefan Zweig was in the habit of sending Freud his writings as they were issued, to which Freud frequently offered his commentary in numerous letters. In response to Zweig's novella, Verwirrung der Gefühle, Confusion of Feelings, Freud wrote the following, which will prove worth quoting at length. Analysis suggests that the great, seemingly inexhaustible wealth of problems and situations treated by the writer can be traced back to a small number of Urban peaks, rooted mostly in the material of repressed experiences of childhood, mental life, so that these poetic fictions correspond to disguised, euphemized, sublimated revisions of those childhood fantasies. This may be shown especially readily in the first novella. Stated bluntly, without sugarcoating, the unconscious core seems repulsive. The motif is that of the mother who introduces the son to sexual intercourse, sacrificing her own person in order to rescue him from the dangers of masturbation, which to the child appear hugely life-threatening. Such a fantasy is remembered consciously by many from their own years of puberty. It is never absent from the unconscious. It also constitutes the basis of all fictions of redemption. Wagner's operas, for example. In fictional treatment, masturbation, which is entirely unsuitable for use, must be replaced with something else. In your novella, play is the proper substitute. The compulsiveness, irresistibility, the relapses despite the firmest resolutions, the threat to life are direct features of the old pattern. The first designation masturbation was given in the nursery was playing. A dangerous game, the child was told, from which one went mad or died. And the emphasis on the hands and their activity achieved with such uncanny mastery by you is downright revelatory. In masturbation, after all, the hands affect their genital function. In your novella, the young player's role as son is indicated so unmistakably that it is hard to believe you had not pursued a conscious intention. I know, however, that this was not the case, and that you allowed your unconscious to be at work. Freud's letter is illuminating in numerous ways, not the least his tangential comment concerning Wagner's operas. First, he recognizes unconscious intention in the creation of Zweig's work, paralleling Wagner's acknowledgement of the operation of the unconscious in the creation of his own works. Though the author may well have been unaware of the psychoanalytic dimension of his character's interactions, their secret meaning in composing the work, Freud certifies his depiction as clinically sound. Though Zweig might well abhor it. Next, he identifies the narrative template of Zweig's novella as one of the small number of Urmotifs that manifest themselves perennially in literature and drama. This Urmotiv is, Freud writes, the basis of all fictions of redemption, including Wagner's operas. Freud's subject here is not Wagner's operas per se. The comment is a casual aside, rather out of the blue, which only bolsters its pertinence to Parsifal. Redemption, Freud's word is Erlösung, like Wagner's, constitutes not just a major motif in Parsifal, it is in fact the narrative goal toward which the entire drama makes its determined, leisurely way. Parsifal conforms to Freud's template. To the innocent hero, Gurnemanz poses a series of personal questions, each of which Parsifal answers with a profession of ignorance. He did not know it was a sin to kill the swan, nor where he comes from, nor who his father is, nor who sent him this way, nor so much as his name. To Gurnemanz's exasperated question, what, after all, he does know, Parsifal is pointedly singular. He has a mother. Hetzelaide is her name. Kundry fills in the story for us. His mother gave birth to the child. Fatherless, because Gamoret had been slain in knightly battle. To protect him from the same mortal dangers, his mother had raised him in the wilderness to be a fool. And now Kundry supplies the crucial piece of information. Parsifal's mother has died of a heart broken by Parsifal's abandonment of her. In this narrative, we recognize critical elements of Freud's Urmotiv, the motif of the mother who sacrifices the son to sexual intercourse durch Preisgabe ihrer eigenen Person, sacrificing her own person in order to rescue him from the dangers of masturbation, which to the child appear hugely life-threatening. To be sure, Kundry's narrative in Act One does not explicitly include the introduction to sexual intercourse of Freud's Urmotiv, but that Oedipal dimension will be acted out overtly in the seduction scene of Act Two, with Kundry herself playing the role of mother seducer. Well, let's now consider the Grail ritual itself. To illuminate the underlying essential nature of Wagner's Grail, it will be useful to list its attributes abstracted from narrative context. The Grail, then, is a vessel whose function is to contain blood. Initially, the blood of Christ, the blood of Christ transubstantiated from wine at the Last Supper, and then the blood that flowed from Christ's side, pierced as he hung on the cross by the Spear of Longinus. Unveiled and revealed, Wagner's Grail glows with an intense, ethereal scarlet effusion that floods the entire temple with blood-colored light and affects the transubstantiation of the wine and bread at the Grail Night's feast table into the Eucharistic blood and body of the Redeemer. A further attribute of Wagner's Grail is its periodicity. Normally concealed, it is periodically brought out for the reenactment of the ritual. Uncovered, its insubstantial bleeding provokes renewed actual bleeding from Amfortas's wound. He cries out, "I feel the sacred vessel's most holy fount of blood pour into my heart. The surge of my own sinful blood in mad flight must flow again into the world of thraldom to sin, pouring itself out in wild fear. Once again it bursts open the gateway through which it gushes, now, here, through the wound." To distill these attributes a step further, we can summarize that the Grail is a blood-containing vessel, normally hidden from sight, that displayed at regular intervals to pour forth its contents. If we add to this picture the commonly recognized female-male genital symbolism of the Grail and Holy Spear in Parsifal, we have in the orbit of the Grail an unmistakable image of the female menstrual cycle. Not the least remarkable aspect of this cycle is the operative taboo under which menstruation is ostensibly hidden from view, whereas in actual its actual manifestations are in fact a most ordinary and indeed generally quite visible fact of everyday life. The taboo, nonetheless, renders the subject, in effect, perversely unmentionable, except at the Freud Museum. In the 19th century, before the development of commercial sanitary pads, women's menstruation was a particularly visible phenomenon, manifested regularly in bloody rags, blood-stained clothing and bedsheets, blood-infused bath water, and not uncommonly, vestiges of blood along the floor. We noted the almost violent linkage Amfortas draws in his monologue between his wound and the scarlet effusion emanating from the uncovered Grail. That ethereal essence flowing from the sacred vessel provokes a renewed and agonizing surge of bleeding from Amfortas' wound, the wound that will never heal. In fantasy, it is commonplace, not only in the context of psychoanalysis, to regard the vagina as a wound. Carl Abraham, for instance, stresses that the menstrual flow of blood only serves to reinforce this basic fantasy. Quote, "The primary idea of the wound is reanimated by the impression created by the first and each succeeding menstruation, and then once again by defloration, for both processes are connected with loss of blood and thus resemble an injury." Let us pause at this point to sort out and, if possible, coordinate the various thematic threads we have discerned in the symbolism of the Grail ritual at the heart of Act One: the primal scene, the Oedipus complex, the seductive self-sacrificing mother, the wound, the castration complex, masturbation, and menstruation. Are we confronting an incoherent semiotic jumble, or are these diverse themes connected in some consistent matrix of relationships? To my mind, simply articulating them in this way virtually answers the question. The primal scene reinforces the Oedipus complex. The ore motif of the self-sacrificing seductive mother constitutes a special case of the Oedipus complex, which entails the retributive threat of castration. Masturbation represents a parallel route to the same dreaded punishment embodied in the primal wound, which in turn seems to be confirmed in the periodic and very manifest phenomenon of menstrual bleeding. We need add only that the appearance of gender ambiguity in the mix of castration and menstrual imagery is resolved in the infantile fantasy that bleeding from the genital wound is no less than confirmation of the reality of the castration threat. However, this blending of gender is further justified in Act Three when we see Kundry expire into identity with Parsifal. We shall return to this theme of androgyny. Let us turn now to Act Two, the dramatic center of gravity of the work. The act takes place in the magic flower garden of the sorcerer Klingsor, in which the flowers metamorphose into seductive women intent on ensnaring our virginal hero to Klingsor's nefarious ends. Gregory is a flower too, a rose of hell. And a heaven holds it, as Klingsor dubs her. In fact, she is his principal flower. Of flowers, Freud wrote unambiguously, blossoms and flowers represent the female genitals. Do not forget that the blossoms are really the genitals of the plants. So Parsifal's seduction is to take place aptly in a luxuriant garden, redolent of the thinly veiled symbolism of the vagina. But Parsifal is proof against the flattery of the flower maidens. Desist, you won't catch me, he says. The musical setting of his rebuff also takes a sudden turn from frivolous to sternly serious. And now, above the extended chord, the orchestra has begun under Parsifal's final word, nicht. And on the same note, an octave higher, comes what is surely the most electrifying moment of this entire Bühnenweihfestspiel, as Kundry calls out to him, Parsifal, weile. Parsifal's nicht dissolving into Kundry's Parsifal, as though their two bodies were already merging into one. It is an effect so arresting and erotic, we understand at once that the action has risen to an altogether more serious level than the frivolous flirtations of the flower maidens. Parsifal is the name he could not recall in response to Gurnamansa's questioning. At its sound on Kundry's lips, he muses, dreaming once my mother called me that. This revelation of his name is merely a prelude to the pivotal, shattering insight he will experience in Kundry's kiss. If in Act One, Kundry has served as Herzelina's ambassador, now in Act Two, she becomes quite overtly Parsifal's mother surrogate, the object of Oedipal fantasy. Kundry recounts how Herzelina, still mourning her husband Gomeret's deaths in knightly combat, had determined to save Parsifal from a similar fate by retiring far into the forest, living cut off from courtly and martial society. Here plainly is the theme of maternal sacrifice. Oh, what pleasure and laughter when she then, this is Kundry speaking, what pleasure and laughter when she then, searching, finally found you, when then her arm embraced you passionately. Did you not then even fear her kisses? Parsifal had strayed ever further and for longer periods from his mother's home, Kundry relates, until finally he abandoned her altogether. She waited through nights and days until her laments fell silent, her grief gnawed at her pain. She pleaded for quiet death. The sorrow broke her heart. And Herzelina died. Recall Freud's pointed formulation of maternal sacrifice, durch Preisgabe ihrer eigenen Person. Hearing Kundry's story, Parsifal berates himself. Woe, woe, what have I done? Where was I? Mother, sweet, gracious mother, your son had to murder you. Oh, fool! Stupid, staggering fool, where were you straying about, forgetting her, forgetting yourself, yourself, beloved, most precious mother? The sophistry of Kundry's reply insinuates her physical caresses. Confession will end guilt and remorse, she said. Knowledge will turn foolishness into sense. Come to know the love that embraced Gomeret, when the flames of Herzelina's passion flooded, burning over him. Once again, Freud's Urmotiv, the mother who introduces the son to sexual intercourse. Kundry, mother's messenger, mother's surrogate, now merges her identity fully with Herzelina's. She who once lent you life and limb, whom death and foolishness must yield to, she offers you today as mother's blessings, final greeting, love's first kiss. I apologize for the clumsiness of that English translation. Wagner's German is very elegant and impossible to translate. Bending over, Parsifal Kundry kisses him long and passionately on the mouth, as Wagner's stage directions stipulate. Kundry is Herzeweide, Parsifal Gameret. Thus is the primal scene not merely witnessed or fantasized, but enacted in the flesh. Kundry and Parsifal remain locked in a long embrace during which the music is at first ruminative, then increasingly agitated. Parsifal starts up, clutching his heart, and cries suddenly, "Amfortas, the wound, it burns here in my side." In sexual congress with Kundry, just short of penetration, Parsifal has had an epiphany, to be sure, although its exact nature merits closer scrutiny. It is not obvious, for instance, why his arousal and embrace with Kundry should put Parsifal in mind of the wound in Amfortas's side. Presumably, the actual threat to Parsifal lying vulnerable in Kundry's arms would be from Klingsor, wielding the holy spear as when he inflicted the wound on Amfortas. But Klingsor is nowhere in evidence at this point. He reappears only near the end of the act. What in Kundry's embrace then would put Parsifal in mind of the wound? The fantasy of the vagina as wound is commonplace, whether derived from the idea that the lack of a penis implies castration or from the sight of menstrual blood. As noted, Wagner's immediate source, Wolfgang's Parsifal, identifies Amfortas's wound explicitly as genital. The witnessing child typically interprets the primal scene as a violent interaction between parents, resulting in injury to one or both. "I saw the wound bleeding," cries Parsifal. "Now it bleeds in me. Here, here." But he abruptly shifts from the vision of a bleeding wound to the sensation of desire burning in his heart. "No, no, it is not the wound. Let its blood flow away. Here, here in my heart, the blaze." The desire, the terrible desire that seizes and masters all my senses. Oh, agony of love. In one sense, we have here a heightened version of the struggle between that tears Tannhäuser apart between lust for Venus and chaste longing for Elizabeth. More important, the shift from bleeding wound to searing pain in the heart is tantamount to a shift of focus from Amfortas, male, to Herzeleide, female. Herz, heart, and Leid, injury, wrong, heart, hurt. This is not so much a shift from male to female as an inclusion of female with male, like the combined parent concept Melanie Klein saw as typical of the primal scene, or more generally, the concept of the androgyne. It is also a sublimation, a displacement upwards from the genitals to the higher, less erotically freighted and tabooed regions of the body. Parsifal's abrupt shift from wound to burning heart is really a form of denial. Where, after all, is the burning passion of erotic arousal felt? Not in the heart, to be sure, but in the genitals. If we say we do feel the passion of love in the heart, or what seems to be the heart, nevertheless, it cannot be said that what Parsifal feels for Kundry is love in any meaningful sense of the word. Her seduction is overtly and exclusively sexual, with the aim of ensnaring Parsifal in service to the sorcerer Klingsor. There is no question of involvement of the heart in this affair. Parsifal says as much when he describes what he is feeling, how everything shudders, quakes, and twitches in sinful craving. Now there is a second sudden shift in his monologue. According to Wagner's stage direction, Parsifal falls into... Okay. falls into a complete... I'm getting there. According to Wagner's stage direction, Parsifal falls into a complete rapture. The last word might also be translated as trance. He is lost in a vision of the Grail, the vessel of salvation, as he calls it, in which the holy blood begins to glow. Bliss of redemption, divinely mild, trembles far and wide in every soul. Only here in my heart will the agony not ease. Kundry tries to snap him out of his trance state. Promised hero, flee the delusion. But Parsifal, still kneeling, vividly depicts Amfortas' seduction. Yes, this voice, this is how she called him, and this look, I recognize it clearly. And this that laughed at him so illicitly, the lips, yes, this is how they quivered for him. This is how her neck bent down. This is how she lifted her head boldly. This is how laughingly her curls fluttered. Just so her arm twined about his neck. Just so her cheek fawned softly. Leagued with all torments of pain, she kissed away from him the salvation of his soul. Ha! This kiss. With this fantasy of the seduction of Amfortas, subsumed under the work's rubric of midnight, compassion, Parsifal graphically projects the primal scene, only marginally displaced in that Kundry and Amfortas are stand-ins for Helzelide and Gamoret. Kundry, for that matter, has so closely identified herself with Parsifal's mother as to have merged functionally with her in any case. We noted that Amfortas' wound, like the wound of the Grail King in all the medieval sources, is a marginally displaced genital wound, and hence represents castration fear. Now we are in a position to pierce to the heart of the mystery of Parsifal, the idea of redemption at its core. On the story's surface, the primal sin that menaces the Grail knighthood and for which Amfortas has suffered is the debilitating wound, the sin from whose brink Parsifal has stepped back just at the last redeeming instance, is sexual intercourse. Redemption from the stain, the curse of this sin, lies in chastity. Parsifal sets off on his road to redemption when he recoils from Kundry's fatal kiss and rejects her attempt at seduction, though the temptation was great and has shaken him to his core. Parsifal and those Grail knights who have not succumbed to Kundry's charms or to the flower maidens find redemption in chastity, lived out in mastery of, in defiance of the lusts of the flesh. But what sense does this actually make? Is intercourse per se really a sin? Is chastity truly a viable or desirable way of life in the context of 19th century bourgeois German society? Does the renunciation of sex constitute the essence of virtue in the real world? This dichotomy and its attendant dilemma are essentially the same as those at the heart of Tannhäuser, as well as of countless artistic works in Western civilization. Nonetheless, Wagner, the sensualist, never behaved as though he subscribed to such desiccated moralism in real life, causing one's overbearing frigidity notwithstanding. It is significant that in Parsifal, sexuality is entirely dissociated from procreation and even from love. It figures as an autonomous and perilous drive, doubtless related to Schopenhauer's unconscious will. We can make sense of Parzival only if we regard it as an allegory, or to use the Freudian term, a sublimation. Quite overtly in Parzival, the consequence of sexual intercourse is the threat of castration, the genital wound inflicted by Klingsor with the holy, or more pointedly, phallic spear. This is precisely the anxiety at the heart of the child's experience of the primal scene, the emotional and ontogenetic motif informing this Bühnenpfeif-Festspiel. Witnessing or fantasizing parental sex is first of all an exclusionary experience. The parent couple is engaged in a private act from which the child is excluded, which it can only observe voyeuristically. But the vicarious experience is exciting and prompts identification with one or both parents. Typically, the experience provokes an Oedipal response. In the male child, the wish to assume the position of the father, that is, to have intercourse with his mother. This wish, in turn, triggers the fear of castration, meted out in fantasy by an avenging father. To evade this catastrophe, Parzival pushes Kundry away. You're pressing me to wrap up. I can tell, Ivan. Let me see if I can jump to what can I leave out? Well, what? Just stop.
Okay. The word that's left out. What the redemption means is just that the what is the sensation of redemption? So it's a particular.
Let me see if I can. Well, let me just jump to the end of my talk, and I'm sorry, but I had already cut out large sections of this talk. You'll just have to read my book. On a deeper psychological level, we see, I'm just going to jump brutally to the end here. On a deeper psychological level, we see at work here Wagner's own well-known and documented proclivity towards assuming female identity. I'm now talking about the merger of the identities of Parzival and Kundry, which is so clear in the third act. His penchant for dressing in women's clothes, his requirements for silk undergarments purportedly to accommodate the sensitivity of his skin brought on by lifelong erysipelas, his love of perfumed baths and florid flamboyant decor. Quote, this high-minded composer of monumental music dramas was also a sybarite on a grand scale, with a particular penchant for silks and satins. From his violet velvet drapes to his pink silk underwear, his tastes became the stuff of the gossip sheets and satirical cartoons, writes Barry Millington. The relationship between Parzival and Kundry is then a projection of such gender confusion, and the androgynous synthesis of their relationship in Parzival's denouement constitutes a resolution in fantasy whose aim is the allaying of anxiety. Gazing rapturously up at Parzival, Kundry sinks expiring to the ground, her being essentially dissolving into his. Recapitulating Herzelide's death, Kundry had announced in Act I, and conforming to Freud's Ur-motif of the mother who sacrifices herself in initiating the son to sexual intercourse. Kundry has effected this initiation quite literally. Although Parzival retreated from the brink of penetration, we can legitimately consider this congress an instance of coitus interruptus. And Parzival has come away from it miraculously enlightened. At bottom, the androgynous fantasy is resolution of both gender ambivalence and the Oedipus complex, miraculously achieving union or reunion with the mother while artfully dodging the punishment of castration. In summary, then, to Parsifal, Gordamas has posed the primal question, Weißt du, was du sahst? Do you know what you saw? This question is an enigma whose solution becomes the goal of the pure fool's arduous quest. The answer, the primal scene, is experienced by our hero in the flesh, viscerally and shatteringly, in Kundry's passionate embrace. The emotional sequelae following upon that erotical enlightenment, guilt, remorse, compassion, and finally absolution, constitute the measured denouement of Parsifal, which culminates in a fantasy of redemption and resolution of primal anxiety.
See if we can have a couple of minutes for questions anyway. I'll throw it out to I think that just going back to the possible idea of the castration drama, what you're saying there is that the dramatic form is not about defeating the father and getting the tithes, but about circumventing anxiety and achieving another kind of resolution.
Yes.
The only thing
and
that I...
And it is a fantasy.
Yeah. The only thing I...
Let me just say also, it is a fantasy, and it's striking that this opera, Parsifal, ends very differently from The Ring. The Ring ends in pessimism. Parsifal ends in optimism, which is an illusion, but just the opposite.
But I suppose I'd say that what seems to be missing in what you said, and where there is an element of optimism as well, is in the relationship to the father. And so in other words, that the redemption occurs in an assumption of the identity, not just with Kundry and this androgyny, but in the assumption of being taken into the arms of a loving father, in fact. And that's what happens. So this kind of unique thing that Wagner did, and it is absolutely amazing. I know, it might sound sort of strange that I would think of it as so amazing, but to have as the same moment where he's symbolically killing the father and taking his place and curing him and healing him and being reconciled to him, I think that is absolutely an amazing achievement in terms of what narrative is. And of course, and some of the things you're saying around that sort of, circumventing of the anxiety is leading to that moment. That's all I suppose the thing, the central scene with Kundry and the kiss, by putting it, I think the final scene is terribly important, obviously, but by saying that Kundry turns herself into her slider, that's absolutely obvious. What isn't so obvious is that Parsifal has turned into Gamera. So Parsifal in that scene is still the child in relation to the mother, and of course that then motivates the image of castration and the threat and so on is then just simply motivated by the fact that he's not now the father in that moment, but he's still the child with a threat looming as well. So I think that there is something there as well, that the father is brought in more sort of in a slightly different way.
Well, I don't think that there is any equivalent to the killing of the father that we see so obviously in the ring. There's much more an identification of Parsifal with Gamrat.
It's not the killing of the father that's the issue, it's getting away with it.
Well, yes.
That's the issue. In, obviously,
I mean, that is the fantasy of the redemption.
Yeah.
That is the conclusion of the opera. Yes, it's a fantasy, but it is a fantasy, an illusion.
Yeah. And how optimistic to think that you might be able to get away with it. Anyway, so thanks for that. You know, I really enjoyed that.